This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. About a year and a half ago, a really interesting store opened in Kunming, China. And it was a store that you'd probably recognize, an Apple store. Except for one thing. It was all counterfeit. The gadgets, the store, everything. Now, the store got a lot of media attention, but of course, we're all used to the pervasiveness of counterfeit goods. For example, there are many more fake Louis Vuitton Gucci bags than there are real ones. And as counterfeiting grows more powerful, almost everything is now being counterfeited, from tennis shoes to cancer drugs. So here to talk about the new wave of counterfeiting, what it means, how you fight it, and what it tells us about our culture is Renee Richardson-Goslin, assistant professor at MIT's Sloan School, and Alina Halloran, a vice president at OPSEC Security. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So Alina Halloran, I'm going to start with you. Is counterfeiting growing? How big an industry are we talking about here?
Absolutely, Kara. In fact, the industry itself is valued at $650 billion. So the numbers are staggering, and we're seeing growth. And one of the ways that we can measure that growth is based on customs seizure statistics. So in 2011, we saw a 24% increase in seizures of counterfeit goods at customs. And those goods can range from, like you said, anything from pharmaceutical drugs to sneakers to apparel, accessories, luxury goods. I mean, it runs the gamut. So any product that is popular and in demand by the public is a target for counterfeiters, of course. They're opportunists.
So this is when things get off the plane or they get off the boat from wherever they're coming from, and the government's looking through them and they find, as you said, more than $600 billion of counterfeit goods.
Exactly right.
Okay, so why is this happening? Why such a huge growth in counterfeiting?
There are a couple of drivers. First and foremost, many years ago, we obviously began outsourcing manufacturing to places like China and other areas where intellectual property laws certainly aren't the same as they are here in the U.S. So that kind of started the ball rolling. But where we've really seen the explosive growth is the advent of the internet. So the internet now provides a global platform for counterfeiters to sell direct to consumers, as well as to online shop operators or even, you know, brick and mortars who are looking for deep discounts because, you know, they're competing with big box retailers, et cetera. So it's not only a place where consumers are buying products, but it's also a sourcing platform.
Now, Renee Goslin from MIT, why is China such a big problem here? And isn't there pressure on them to stop counterfeiting goods from, you know, major companies like Apple or North Face or Louis Vuitton, whatever?
Absolutely. I think part of the reason is that many of the boundaries of production have been lowered by outsourcing. So there's access that's been unprecedented. I think also you have a burgeoning wealthier class in China, as well as intellectual property laws that are different than the United States. There is sort of a more of a sense of a communal ownership. And so the notion of having a trademark that cannot be replicated is fairly a recent notion. So I think all of these things have made a very fertile environment. You've got people who are more familiar with status brands, have more disposable income. You have laws that were not as strict and a communal culture. And you have outsourcing. This sort of creates a perfect storm for this type of problem.
Now, we've seen just in recent weeks, millions seized in counterfeit goods, in DVDs, in CDs. There was a huge seizure in Britain. But in Massachusetts, we've seen people arrested for selling fake Louis Vuitton, Gucci, Uggs, North Face, Burberry, Coach. So, Renee Goslin, I know you've done work on this. Is your sense that when people buy fake stuff that they know they're buying it, or are they being duped? They think they're buying a North Face jacket and they are not.
Yeah, I'd say there are about three buckets of people. There are those who intentionally seek counterfeits. They have no intention of paying for the real thing, and they're price sensitive to the point where quality is not a concern. Those people tend not to move over into the legitimate purchase group. The second group are people who are being duped. They're seeking the right the correct thing, but somehow are using a channel that has been infiltrated. And the second group may be the largest group, which are people who are looking for the right thing, may think they are getting too good of a deal, but aren't doing that much effort to seek out whether the truth is that they're getting a counterfeit or that they're getting the real thing. They sort of would prefer kind of not to dig into it and get a deep discount. And they not know.
They sort of know it's too good to be true, yes. But it's pretty good. So
exactly.
They're hoping it's true.
Why go there? Just,
right.
You know, let it be.
Exactly. So Alina Haller and I wonder, what are the scariest things? You know, everybody's so familiar with the bags, the Uggs, you know, that kind of stuff being counterfeited. What are you seeing, though, that's being counterfeited that might surprise people?
Certainly pharmaceutical drugs, I think, would surprise and scare people. And we know that the value of counterfeit prescription drugs is $200 billion of the $650 billion pie of counterfeit of the counterfeit industry. I would also say that certain day-to-day types of items are also being counterfeited, things like toothpaste, skincare items, cosmetics, things that I don't think people necessarily would think about because they're not high-end, you know, in certain cases. So everyday items, we've seen toothpaste being made with antifreeze and things like that. So when you move toward products that are being ingested or used on your body, certainly the risks go up immensely. And now we have risk of injury to consumers.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH. We are talking about the new world of counterfeiting. And Alina Halloran, okay, that's pretty scary to think about toothpaste being made with antifreeze. I assume then when you are talking about prescription drugs being counterfeited, these are not nearly as good or as effective as the real prescription would be.
That's right, Kara. So in some cases, you may not have the active ingredient in the product at all, or you could have other ingredients that are harmful to the consumer. And that's really what's scary. And as we know, many U.S. consumers are going to the internet to find better deals, to purchase drugs perhaps from Canada. And, you know, there are many website owners who put a maple leaf and a Canadian flag on the website to make it look as though it's a legitimate Canadian pharmacy when, in fact, product is coming perhaps from China, India, or Latin America. So those are concerns that, you know, I think to your point, Renee, consumers need to look a little more deeply into whether this is too good to be true or not, particularly for those kinds of products.
Now, is this really worrying, like the Mercks and the Pfizers? I mean, what do you do if you're Pfizer to distinguish between what's real, what's not, to make sure that things do not get in the pipeline that are going to, you know, really hurt people or at the very least, maybe not treat them for something that they need to be treated for?
That's a great question. And, you know, brand owners across the board are doing a lot of work to combat the problem. And I don't think that the general public realizes just how much goes into it. It's not just one line item or one or two people. It's a cross-functional group of individuals within an organization working with outside counsel, working with field investigators, looking at on-product technologies like OPSEC provides, looking at the internet to identify large networks of perpetrators. So it's a very big problem and one that many companies are spending a lot of time and resources to combat.
Now, Renee Gosselin, if you are Gucci or you're Louis Vuitton and you make a product where there's honestly so many more fake products than there are real ones, what do you do about that? Do you care? How do you begin to fight that?
I think you care a lot. I think it's pretty terrifying to see the product that you've crafted and sort of ushered into the marketplace in dingy back areas, falling apart in these black market channels. I think there are a few things you can do. I think that you can, first of all, inform your consumer base. I mean, there are two sort of sides to this coin. One are the consumers who own the authentic thing, and the other are the consumers who own the fakes. I think you have to do some education for both sides, because the consumers who own the real thing, actually, when they are empowered with the ability to tell the real from the fake, they tend to be very active in keeping those people out and not allowing them to have access to all that the brand means. So in my research, for example, You can see groups on Facebook, right? My favorite one is called "Darling, I can tell by the rest of your outfit that your Louis Vuitton is fake." So there's like a shaming ritual here where people identify those who are clearly using counterfeits and punish them socially. And these are sort of punishments that are outside of the hands of the brand owner. But these sort of judgments based on the consumers are due to the fact that the brand owner has identified consumers who are real and educated them about what the real thing is. So you can have a really good conversation with your consumers. I think some of the technology that's emerging is really important to telling the real from the fake. And I think that also there's an innovation cycle that needs to be rapid enough so that it's more difficult for the people who are imitating to catch up with you. It's a difficult thing to do, but as you're keeping innovation and fresh product out there, those people have to try and catch up. And to the extent that they can't, you can keep them at bay.
So what you're saying is make a new style of bag every year or something so that it's really hard for the people who are waiting for the bag to come out and then developing it to stay up with the real.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at the bags that are imitated, they tend to be of one kind. They tend to be fairly simple in their pattern, and they tend to be very overt with the branding. So these are people who are looking to really make an announcement. I have a Louis Vuitton, and I want you to be able to read that logo from across the street. So then if you're a brand owner and you start making more subtle designs, more intricate designs, things that are more difficult to imitate, you actually can sort of neutralize the effect of many of these counterfeits. And when you look at what's counterfeited versus not, I think that can give you some clues into what people who are buying the imitations are seeking.
But I know in your research, you have tried to get people to take a look at a bag, they can't touch it, and ask them, can you tell if this is a real or a fake? What did you find out?
They can't.
They can't tell.
And it's not really that important whether they can tell. What's important is whether they think that they can tell. When they can't tell, their difference in willingness to pay for the real versus the fake is their willingness to pay for the real goes down. But when they feel that they can tell, when they're confident in their ability to tell, that is preserved. They're still willing to pay top notch for the real thing. And the driver for their confidence is not looking at the bag, not looking at the zipper or inside. It's looking at who's using the bag. Do you look like you would be a Louis Vuitton customer? I'm not sure if this Louis Vuitton bag coupled with, you know, a jogging suit is really conveying the luxury that you're trying to send across. So if it's not working, they'll dismiss the owner as being an imitator and they'll be fine with purchasing the real thing for top dollar.
So we judge by context.
Absolutely.
We judge you and then we say, okay, yeah, this person might be actually using the real Gucci bag.
That's correct. So you look at the contextual clues that gives you then the judgment of the actual bag.
So, okay, so where does Gucci, the company, play into that scenario?
Well, I think the first thing is that there's a lot of power in the hands of the consumer and not in the hands of the brand. I mean, the brand can do a lot, right? So at last check, I believe Louis Vuitton had 30 full-time attorneys and investigators on staff simply for counterfeiting. And that's an important step. It's important to go to customs and intervene and do those sorts of things. But you've also got to rely on your consumer base to be the sort of gatekeepers. And that is really where you sort of educate your consumers and build a relationship with them. It sounds kind of soft and fuzzy, but this is the sort of thing that when you build loyalty, people will say, you can't do that to my brand. So that's what you as a brand manager also have to cultivate.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking about the world of counterfeiting. And Alina Halloran, Vice President of OPSEC Security. When people hear that shampoo, that toothpaste, that prescription drugs are being counterfeited, I wonder, is there a way of turning this tide, or is this just going to get more and more problematic until we have no sense that the Pantene that we're buying or, the blood pressure drug that people are getting is in fact the real thing?
Let's hope it never gets to that point. Certainly there are lots of legitimate products out there on the shelves, and so we do have to remember that. But I think that, brand owners are working really, really hard to combat the problem. We know that there is pending legislation as well to change some of the laws and make them more stringent to ensure that we protect intellectual property. I mean, this is important for the U.S., really, to ensure that our intellectual property is protected and also to ensure the safety of our consumer base.
And is there going to be a crackdown? For example, we talked a lot about China, and I think more than 60%, right, mm-hmm. of counterfeit goods come from China. But India is becoming a hub for pharmaceutical
Absolutely.
Imitators. So what is there going to be pressure on India to shut those factories down so that you don't get really important medications ripped off in the supply chain?
You have to understand geographically where this issue is coming from and where it's moving to, because it is moving geographically and based on the different types of product categories. You're seeing, you know, counterfeit software coming out of Eastern Europe and Russia. You're seeing the counterfeit drugs coming out of India. So it's important for our government to liaise with these governments to try and stop the problem, because ultimately, you know, only a small percentage of people are benefiting from the counterfeiting, and that's the counterfeiters. So governments are also losing, as is the public.
We're talking about the world of counterfeiting, and we've got much more to get into, including some of those cutting-edge ways of telling the real from the fake. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Boston Public Radio here on 89.7 WGBH. This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. My guests today are Renee Richardson-Goslin, Assistant Professor of Marketing at MIT's Sloan School, and Alina Halloran, Vice President of Global Online Brand Protection Services at OpSec Security. And we're talking about counterfeiting, the huge role it's now playing in our lives, and what we're doing to fight back. And Alina Halloran, I want to turn to you. You've brought some really sort of cutting-edge things here that companies are doing to try to figure out how do you get counterfeit goods off the market? How do you distinguish between what's real and what's fake? Tell me what you've brought.
Sure. So we have an entire portfolio of different types of technologies that can go on a product or be integrated into a product to help both consumers determine whether or not they're buying the genuine article. So, for example, if you're buying a Patriots jersey, you would look for that hologram on the hang tag. That's sort of become a fashion statement, if you will. Many consumers leave that product on, let's say, a cap, a Red Sox cap. They'll wear the cap with the hologram. But in addition to a coolness factor that many people have used this for, we have embedded technology into these holograms that help us determine whether or not the product is in fact genuine and where it came from and so forth. We also have different types of labels. We have security threads that can go directly into the label inside of apparel, purses, things of that nature, or be woven directly into apparel. So in this case, you wouldn't even know it exists, but
yeah,
it's there.
You're holding up a thread that's so thin. I mean, it's just like, you know, a little bit of cloth. But so the idea is that somebody at customs, let's say, would know that it was there. Is
exactly
that right?
Exactly right. So we have different types of levels of security features where we would train customs on what to look for. So if they get a shipment of goods that they suspect is counterfeit, they can take a device typically and make a determination very quickly, because otherwise, without the technology, you've got to call in the brand owner, they've got to make an appearance, they've got to determine whether or not it's counterfeit, and customs doesn't have time to keep all of that product for days until it's confirmed. So the technology allows that seizure, if the product is counterfeit, to move much more quickly. So I think having these tools provides a lot more to combating the problem, and we also have certain features that only select individuals know about so that we can really ensure.
I was going to ask that. Now, I'm wondering, once you start doing NFL or Major League Baseball merchandise and you put a hologram on it, aren't people who are doing the knockoffs going to say, you know what, we need hologram stickers on our Major League Baseball knockoff merchandise.
And we have to stay one step ahead. So, you know,
so you've seen that.
Absolutely. And what we're doing is we're constantly evaluating, because what the counterfeiter is going to do is that they're going to fake it as little as possible. So they're going to spend as little as they can just so that it passes muster to the consumer. And we're always looking at, you know, whether or not they've tried to duplicate what we manufacture. And we've always got technology features to stay ahead of the game.
Now, I wonder, how often do big stores, let's say a Target or a Macy's or a Walmart, you know, order a bunch of products, whether it be Apple, whether it be Levi's jeans, and find at customs that they're not real? Does that happen?
You know, I'd say it's happening more, and here's why. I think because we're still in an economic downturn, I think that big box retailers are always looking for ways to cut costs, right? So perhaps they're ordering from new suppliers and they're looking for better deals so that they can pass those deals on to consumers. So I think those issues can, you know, allow counterfeits to infiltrate a genuine supply chain. And we are seeing evidence of that happening.
Renee Gosselin from MIT. The question then is, if you have a great idea for a new running shoe, you know, or a new way of creating blue jeans, or the new best cell phone, aren't you discouraged from creating that if you know people are just going to knock it off for much cheaper the minute you create it?
I think that that's one of the biggest potential risks of counterfeiting. If we don't sort of get a handle on it, it becomes a disincentive for innovation, because if you are easily imitated and no longer have ownership over your innovation, it seems less worthwhile. With my students, my MBA is at Sloan, and they're heavily into entrepreneurship. I think one of the biggest things, or one of the biggest weapons you can have actually, is to consider imitation in the first place. Many innovators and entrepreneurs come up with their new sort of invention, put it out onto the market, and think about counterfeiting after the fact. It's too late.
Yeah, it's been ripped off.
It's been ripped off, and now you're scrambling to react to something, and they're just simply going to follow in lockstep with you, your innovations. So I think that the best tool you can have actually is to think strategically before your item gets out into market and think, how easy is this to replicate? Because when you have success, the blessing is you have success and all that brings. The curse is that other people will look around and say, I kind of want that too. And they want to do it, as Alina said, for the least amount of effort and cost on their part. That second mover advantage is something that really has to be built in up front.
And this is really the other side of the coin, it seems, from the sort of debate we were having during the election about outsourcing jobs to China. The other side is, well, once you outsource the jobs, people who run those factories know how to make that product. They know
Absolutely.
Everything that goes into it.
Why not add a few extra runs to
exactly.
the assembly line, right? I mean, that's exactly what's going on here. So I think this is a very big issue that hopefully will get consumers galvanized to say, hang on, what do we want in terms of quality, right? Because you have to understand that an imitation is not going to have the same amount of quality as the real thing. And I think then the brand creators have to think to themselves, what kind of quality do we want to provide? If we're providing low quality, that's easily replicated. If we're providing something that's high in quality, that's harder to imitate, and our consumers will be more likely to pay that premium because they don't want to have the risk of, well, toothpaste with arsenic in it, but also mechanical items that malfunction, cell phone batteries that explode. I mean, all of these other things. Why spend your earned money on something that you're just going to have to replace soon enough anyway?
I want to ask you a little bit about how human behavior factors into all of this. Tell us about house parties and how the spreading of counterfeit goods can happen, not just from people we don't know overseas, but here too.
Oh, absolutely. So I attended a lot of parties in the name of science. These were purse parties. Think of the Tupperware party of, you know, your mom's generation. But instead of Tupperware, what's being sold here are counterfeit versions of luxury items, multiple brands that are nicely arranged on the couch, on the dining table, on the sofa, and things of that nature. And I followed these purse parties for 2.5 years to sort of understand, okay, what is going on here? Why are these upper middle class to high income people engaging in this behavior? And more importantly, what does this happen? What does this mean over time? And what I found was following these people versus the people who buy counterfeits off the street in sort of, you know, the back alleys, really gave me insights into what counterfeiting means. For these people, the meaning or the value that they get out of the product is really social in nature. It's, oh, I love that bag on you. That would so work on you. That looks great. And being able to connect with other people through the things that they purchase.
Now, would you say these are people who mostly can afford the real thing? Or
that's
can?
Right.
They can.
These are people who live in, you know, beautiful large homes, drive luxury automobiles, multiple luxury automobiles, and certainly could afford the product. However, they engaged in these purse parties for the social aspect. Why not sort of talk about our husbands and children and drink some wine and maybe do a little shopping?
But not why not have purse parties with real Gucci and Louis Vuitton and Chanel bags? Why have them with all these fake bags?
Well, you can have you cannot have the purse parties with real bags. It's not an option. But I think there was a little bit of a thrill of danger, a thrill of walking on the wild side, if you will. And all of that sort of made kind of a fun little cocktail party. And these are really good people. I want to be clear. I mean, these are people that you probably sit next to you in church or at the PTA. But they were engaging in these behaviors. And I think if we think that the purchasers of counterfeits are these sort of, you know, scary individuals, no, they're us. And so following these people, what I found, though, was that there became this tension between the good people that they are and what they were doing.
Right.
Right. They got lots of compliments. I love that bag. And because they purchased them in a social context, they felt compelled to admit, well, actually, I got it at this purse party. It's not real. And this whole sort of narrative had to tumble out in order to sort of warrant the compliment. And over time, what happens is these people decided it's not worth it. It's not worth it to constantly explain this bad behavior. It's not worth it because the product is not as good. And it's not worth it because as I learn more about the real product, I realize it's kind of nice. And I'm not getting that great of a deal. And what I found was nearly 70% of these people over time not only dumped the fake, but converted to the real thing. In this way, and I was shocked by these outcomes, by the way, in this way, having a negative counterfeiting experience actually taught these people that counterfeits absolutely are not worth it. But I think that this negative counterfeiting experience could perhaps be prevented by some of the mechanisms we could put in place that Alina is talking about. But also, maybe, you know, sometimes you have to touch a hot stove to learn not to touch it again.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the people you found who actually did the sort of back alley, New York City's Chinatown buying, they felt a lot better in the long run about their purchase.
They
because
sure did.
Nobody knew.
That's right.
What they had.
They could keep that under the hat and go around with their quote-unquote Louis Vuitton. And people would be none the wiser, or so they thought.
And I wonder, with the house parties, how much money are we talking about here? Is this small money? Is it big money when you look at the house party network?
Oh, we're talking big money. So, you know, you have these homes where you have, on average, 50 to 100 bags in a home. But those people get those bags from these distributors, typically in New York City. Those distributors are coming from the factories in China. So really, when you go back to the root, we're talking billions of dollars.
Wow, wow. Alina Halloran from OPSEC Security. So look ahead for us. What is the next wave of counterfeiting that companies are really worried about? Is it in the high-tech goods? Is it the iPhones and the iPads? Is it pharmaceutical, you know, drugs that's about to explode? What do you see coming?
It's all of the above. I mean, it's really across every category. What was interesting last year when we looked at the custom seizures, we, for the past 5 years, have seen footwear as the number one seized product. And last year, that was replaced by mobile phones. So we are seeing a little bit of a shift here. But, you know, I would say any product that is popular is absolutely a target. And I don't think any company should sit back and say, well, gee, it's not going to happen to us. And, you know, I like Renee's point about being a bit more proactive. And we've worked with companies during the design and launch phase of, you know, new product development in, you know, these are typically companies that have been burned before on past products that have been successful. So they've learned through, you know, hard lessons, and they've been able to build technology into the packaging or into the product and create programs to monitor the internet early on to send a strong message and perhaps send the counterfeiters to another brand, for instance.
And to underscore how hard it is to distinguish, I know you've seen the government, which normally is trying to actually do the policing, mistakenly purchase fake goods.
That's right. That's right. There was a very large case in the last year and a half or so of the government procuring counterfeit Cisco products. I mean, that's highly concerning from a national security standpoint. And we know that the government, you know, goes to great lengths to protect their supply chain. So these things are happening.
And brand managers, too, get fooled. I mean, they use the fake golf clubs and the real ones, and they can't tell the difference.
We're going to keep our eye on this as it grows and is checked on the other side by the government and others. Renee Richardson-Goslin, assistant professor at MIT Sloan School, and Alina Halloran, vice president of global online brand protection services at OPSEC Security. Thank you very much, both of you, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kara.
And now from one growing sector to another, today 20% of Americans are atheist, agnostic, or unaffiliated with any religion. So as we enter a season dense with religious celebrations, what will they be doing to mark the holidays? Callie Crossley will bring you that story. I'm Kara Miller, and you're listening to Boston Public Radio.